Welcome to Between the Lines. Listening to literature online. This is show number 136, American Apartheid, Part 2. Again, reading from The New Jim Crow, Mass Incarceration in the Age of Color Blindness by Michelle Alexander. At the time of this printing, she is an associate professor of law at Ohio State University and holds a joint appointment at the Kirwan Institute for the Study of Race and Ethnicity. Formerly the director of the ACLU's Racial Justice Project in Northern California, Alexander served as a law clerk for U.S. Supreme Court Justice Harry A. Blackmun. The title of the show comes from a book, American Apartheid by Massey and Denton, which I didn't quite realize till after titling the show, but subconscious titling there. In any case, it's part two, what looks to be four parts or so. This is your host, Monk. Thank you for listening. Few notes before getting to chapter two, a little review that was after the civil rights movement. Then crime became the label of segregation with the war of drugs, I'm now calling it. And racism card, fast forward to Islamophobia, black and white divide and rule. And a lot of it, it's black's fault, in the way the poor get blamed a lot, and it's not the system. And also I have an underlined note, a basic modus operandi, find an enemy, divide and rule, and fund and control, because this book highlights, you know, not new, but sometimes I hear stuff or read stuff over and over and then hear it again and it really clicks. It's the way the control is typically funded, you know, follow the money type of thing. And it's summertime. Windows open, so maybe some background noises. Chapter 2 is the lockdown. And it talks about known as the stop and frisk rule, the Terry decision stands for the proposition that so long as a police officer has, quote, reasonable articulable suspicion, end quote, that someone is engaged in criminal activity and dangerous, it is constitutionally permissible to stop, question, and frisk him or her, even in the absence of probable cause. Justice Douglas dissented in Terry on the grounds that granting police greater power than a magistrate or judge is to take a long step down the totalitarian path. The U.S. Supreme Court struck down the basic requirement as unrealistic. This is fast-forwarding to something to do with Ohio Supreme Court. The U.S. Supreme Court struck down this basic requirement as unrealistic. In so doing, the court made clear to all lower courts that, from now on, the Fourth Amendment should place no meaningful constraints on the police in the war on drugs. No one needs to be informed of their rights during a stop or search, and police may use minor traffic stops as well as the myth of consent to stop and search anyone they choose for imaginary drug crimes, whether or not any evidence of illegal drug activity actually exists. So that's been seen in the news where, you know, someone was pulled over for a busted taillight, and then they check the record, and okay, I've heard, you know, sometimes that I've actually caught an escapee or a criminal type, so, you know, it's not an absolute, but it's the premise that gets used, the way, as mentioned in part one, the book emphasizing that the racism card is non-vocalized in the modern times now. And let's see, perhaps the best known of these training programs is Operation Pipeline. The Drug Enforcement Agency, DEA, launched Operation Pipeline in 1984 as part of the Reagan administration's rollout of the War on Drugs. The federal program, administered by over 300 state and local law enforcement agencies, trains state and local law enforcement officers to use pretextual traffic stops and consent searches on a large scale for drug interdiction. Officers learn, among other things, how to use a minor traffic violation as a pretext to stop someone, how to lengthen a routine traffic stop and leverage it into a search for drugs, how to obtain consent from a reluctant motorist, and how to use drug-sniffing dogs to obtain probable cause. And she mentions a time where, you know, I don't know if it was the Supreme Court, but some case was overruled because the defendant had, they could have spoken up for themselves. They could have, I think it was somebody on a bus, that they could have refused permission to be searched. But she makes the point that, you know, under the situation, how many people, the attitude of a policeman wanting to search, how many people, you know, in that sort of moment would be able to, you know, have the wherewithal to say no, and then to, you know, especially if a minority, to then wonder what the consequences might be. And here's one that it's not funny, but it made me chuckle, sort of in a odd sense, from a personal experience. She writes, even striving to obey the law fits the profile. The Florida Highway Patrol drug courier profile cautioned troopers to be suspicious of, quote, scrupulous obedience to traffic laws. So it's like, damned if you do, damned if you don't. But I was remembering a few times in my younger days when I would have a few drinks and drive home, and I think because I was so paying so much attention, I drove perfectly. I mean, just straight on the line, you know, straight on the lines, everything was just right on. And I could see where that, you know, sort of in a detective way, oh, there's somebody suspicious because they're driving so perfectly. But yet again, it is quite Orwellian and kind of creepy to even consider that, you know, the whole arrest system can be based on such a thing. And we've heard of Monsanto's, however you pronounce it, glyphosate, what's been dubbed a probable carcinogen in their weed killer Roundup. Well, there's another kind of Roundup.
This is Michelle Alexander writes, clearly the rules of the game are designed to allow for the roundup of an unprecedented number of Americans for minor, nonviolent drug offenses. The number of annual drug arrests more than tripled between 1980 and 2005 as drug sweeps and suspicionless stops and searches proceeded in record numbers. She's making the point that they're allowed to engage in such wholesale roundup of nonviolent drug offenders does not answer the question to why they would choose to do so, particularly when most police departments have far more serious crimes to prevent and solve. Why would police prioritize drug law enforcement? Drug use and abuse is nothing new. In fact, it was on the decline, not on the rise when the war on drugs began. So why make drug law enforcement a priority? Once again, the answer lies in the system's design. Every system of control depends for its survival on the tangible and intangible benefits that are provided to those who are responsible for the system's maintenance and administration. This system is no exception. At the time of the drug war was declared, illegal drug use and abuse was not a pressing concern in most communities. The announcement of a war on drugs was therefore met with some confusion and resistance within law enforcement, as well as among some conservative commentators. So there you have again why now I'm calling it the war of drugs, because it's using the drugs to wage a kind of social warfare on people. And then here I have a note, the Fed bribed state and local. Huge cash grants were made to those law enforcement agencies that were willing to make drug law enforcement a top priority. The new system of control is traceable to a significant degree to a massive bribe offered to state and local law enforcement by the federal government. In 1988, at the behest of the Reagan administration, Congress revised the program that provides federal aid to law enforcement, renaming it the Edward Byrne Memorial State and Local Law Enforcement Assistance Program after a New York City police officer who was shot to death while guarding the home of a drug case witness. So here you have again where the money is funneling in to feed the system and the rewards. And she goes on to describe in certain cases where it's legal for the police to basically get the booty of, say they do a drug arrest and they can just take the drugs and or take the car or whatever it is, and they can, you know, it's like these incentives for the police to get bonuses, a commission, kind of material commission. Very strange. And then we have criminologist Peter Kroska reports that between 1989 and 2001 at least 780 cases of flawed paramilitary raids reached the appellate level. A dramatic increase over the 1980s when such cases were rare. And transformation from community policing to military policing began in 1981 when President Reagan persuaded Congress to pass the Military Cooperation with Law Enforcement Act, which encouraged the military to give local, state, and federal police access to military bases, intelligence, research, weaponry, and other equipment for drug interdiction. That legislation carved a huge exception to the Posse Comitatus Act, the Civil War era law prohibiting the use of the military for civilian policing. It was followed by Reagan's National Security Decision Directive, which declared drugs a threat to the U.S. national security and provided for yet more cooperation between local, state, and federal law enforcement. In the years that followed, Presidents Bush and Clinton enthusiastically embraced the drug war and increased the transfer of military equipment, technology, and training to local law enforcement, contingent, of course, on the willingness of agencies to prioritize drug law enforcement and concentrate resources on arrests for illegal drugs. Talking about the Reform Act, I'm not sure what that is, but she says, the greatest failure of the Reform Act, however, has nothing to do with one's due process rights once property has been seized in a drug investigation. Despite all the new procedural rules and formal protections, the law does not address the single most serious problem associated with drug war forfeiture laws, the profit motive in drug law enforcement. So, you know, here's where the book highlights all these different the layers of it, the pretextual, the suspicionless stops, the property, people, the forfeiture, if people can't be there or, you know, they don't know how to protect their stuff because of whatever reasons. And here's a little section called Bad Deal. Almost no one ever goes to trial. Nearly all criminal cases are resolved through plea bargaining, a guilty plea by the defendant in exchange for some form of leniency by the prosecutor. Though it is not widely known, the prosecutor is the most powerful law enforcement official in the criminal justice system. One might think the judges are the most powerful, or even the police, but in reality, the prosecutor holds the cards. It is the prosecutor for more than any other criminal justice official who holds the keys to the jailhouse door. After the police arrest someone, the prosecutor is in charge. And she mentions some instances where people thinking that by the pleading guilty, they would get off, you know, the whole plea bargaining thing, they would get off a lighter, but then might, you know, actually get it worse. And a little farther on, nevertheless, harsh mandatory minimum sentences for drug offenders have been consistently upheld by the U.S. Supreme Court. In 1982, the Supreme Court upheld 40 years of imprisonment for possession and attempt to sell 9 ounces of marijuana. Several years later, in Harmelin v. Michigan, the court upheld a sentence of life imprisonment for a defendant with no prior convictions who attempted to sell 672 grams, approximately 23 ounces, of crack cocaine. The court found the sentences imposed in those cases reasonably proportionate to the offenses committed and not cruel and unusual in violation of the Eighth Amendment. This ruling was remarkable given that prior to the Drug Reform Act of 1986, the longest sentence Congress had ever imposed for possession of any drug in any amount was 1 year. A life sentence for a first-time drug offense is unheard of in the rest of the developed world. So yeah, it just shows the absurdity and also the cultural, you know, still liquor. I'm not advocating for or against anything in particular here because that's a whole nother topic, but just the cultural bias is that liquor is okay. You know, liquor is okay. It's socially acceptable. We're still allowed to advertise liquor on TV. You know, sure, there are drunk driving stop, you know, police stops, but that's sort of like just on holidays is where most of that happens. And yeah, the whole percentage of people in prison, a lot of times, the exact statistic, I think it's like 50% are on low. Here she writes, most are low-level minor drug dealers, not drug kingpins. I guess in opposition to the claim that, you know, the war on drugs gets the big kingpins. And further on, some federal judges, including conservative judges, have quit in protest of federal drug laws and sentencing guidelines. Face-to-face with those whose lives hang in the balance, they are far closer to the human tragedy occasioned by the drug war than the legislators who write the laws from afar. So nice to know some of them judges got some conscience. In a section, the prison label, most people imagine that the explosion in the U.S. prison population during the past 25 years reflects changes in crime rates. Few would guess that our prison population leaped from approximately 350,000 to 2.3 million in such a short period of time due to changes in laws and policies, not changes in crime rates. Yet, it has been changes in our laws, particularly the dramatic increases in the length of prison sentences, that have been responsible for the growth of our prison systems, not increases in crime. One study suggests that the entire increase in the prison population from 1980 to 2001 can be explained by sentencing policy changes. Once a person is labeled a felon, he or she is ushered into a parallel universe in which discrimination, stigma, and exclusion are perfectly legal, and privileges of citizenship such as voting and jury service are off limits. It does not matter whether you have actually spent time in prison. Your second-class citizenship begins the moment you are branded a felon. Most people branded felons, in fact, are not sentenced to prison. As of 2008, there were approximately 2.3 million people in prison and jails and a staggering 5.1 million people under, quote, community correctional supervision, end quote. In other words, on probation or parole. So that's another thing I learned from this. You know, you always hear the prison stats, but there's this huge statistic of people not even in prison that are, you know, get caught up in the systemic bias. The extraordinary increase in prison admissions due to parole and probation violations is due almost entirely to the war on drugs. With respect to parole, in 1980, only 1% of all prison admissions were parole violators. 20 years later, more than one-third, 35% of prison admissions resulted from parole violations. To put the matter more starkly, in italics, about as many people were returned to prison for parole violations in 2000 as were admitted to prison in 1980 for all reasons. The disturbing phenomenon of people cycling in and out of prison trapped by their second-class status has been described by someone whose name I try to pronounce, Loic Wacquant, as a, quote, closed circuit of perpetual marginality, end quote. Hundreds of thousands of people are released from prison every year only to find themselves locked out of the mainstream society and economy. Most ultimately return to prison, sometimes for the rest of their lives. Others are released again, only to find themselves in precisely the circumstances they occupied before, unable to cope with the stigma of the prison label and their permanent pariah status. And there it circles back, ironically, to the documentary, The House I Live In, I think it is. The House We Live In. That is because of those situations. This is a general statement that because the economy is so bad, because it's hard to even find work, and especially hard to find work with these labels, that people turn to drug sales to make money, to feed their families or to pay their rent. So, you know, it's like a vicious loop there. And she ends that chapter with, unless the number of people who are labeled felons is dramatically reduced, and unless the laws and policies that keep ex-offenders marginalized from the mainstream society and economy are eliminated, the system will continue to create and maintain an enormous undercast. And chapter 3 is The Color of Justice. She gets into, you know, the effective use of telling a personal story of a drug sweep and some of the effects of that. And she has, in the drug war, the enemy is racially defined. The law enforcement methods are described in Chapter 2, have been employed almost exclusively in poor communities of color, resulting in jaw-dropping numbers of African Americans and Latinos filling our nation's prisons and jails every year. We are told by drug warriors that the enemy in this war is a thing, drugs, not a group of people, but the facts prove otherwise. Although the majority of illegal drug users and dealers nationwide are white, 3/4 of all people in prisons for drug offenses have been black or Latino. There's also a bit farther on where some crazy law about, like, just even being associated with someone, like someone's husband, you know, you're driving the car that a husband made a drug deal in and the wife gets arrested or something because of some kind of strange, like, property can be guilty. I mean, it's so absurd. I'll try to find that one that, that the physical object participated in it. And she points out that violent crime rates are at historically low levels nowadays, but incarceration rates continue to climb. The most important fact to keep in mind, however, is this. Debates about prison statistics ignore the fact that most people who are under correctional control today are not in prison. As noted earlier, of the nearly 7.3 million people currently under correctional control, only 1.6 million are in prison. Sort of a strange phrase to sit and ponder. Correctional control. Another phrase, racialized social control. Here she writes, what is painfully obvious when one steps back from individual cases and specific policies is that the system of mass incarceration operates with stunning efficiency to sweep people of color off the streets, lock them in cages, and then release them into an inferior second-class status. Nowhere is this more true than in the war on drugs. The central question, then, is how exactly does a formerly colorblind criminal justice system achieve such racially discriminatory results? Rather easily, it turns out. The process occurs in two stages. The first step is to grant law enforcement officials extraordinary discretion regarding whom to stop, search, arrest, and charge for drug offenses, thus ensuring that conscious and unconscious racial beliefs and stereotypes will be given free rein. Unbridled discretion inevitably creates huge social disparities. Then, the damning step. Close the courthouse doors to all claims by defendants and private litigants that the criminal justice system operates in racially discriminatory fashion. Demand that anyone who wants to challenge racial bias in the system offer in advance clear proof that the racial disparities are the product of intentional racial discrimination. In other words, the work of a bigot. This evidence will almost never be available in the era of color blindness because everyone knows but does not say that the enemy in the war on drugs can be identified by race. The simple design has helped to produce one of the most extraordinary systems of racialized social control the world has ever seen. And talking about the sort of the subtleties of this stuff, one study suggests that the standard crime news script is so prevalent and so thoroughly racialized that viewers imagine a black perpetrator even when none exists. In that study, 60% of viewers who saw a story with no image falsely recalled seeing one, and 70% of those viewers believed the perpetrator to be African American. Decades of, oh yeah, here's the phrase, a cognitive bias research demonstrates that both unconscious and conscious biases lead to discriminatory actions, even when an individual does not want to discriminate. The quotation commonly attributed to Nietzsche that, quote, there is no immaculate perception, end quote, perfectly captures how cognitive schemas, thought structures, influence what we notice and how the things we notice get interpreted. And I will admit that, I have some of my, I grew up around black people and some of my best friends are black people. But because of that new script, I mean, sometimes, say I'm going to a gas station at night or something, and I've like trained myself to if they're, you know, see minority or black people, it's like just to just really tune in and look past that sort of culturally programmed to flinch and be in fear. So, it's, everybody's got to do what they got to do, but I can understand where that study's coming from. Okay, now here's one that I wanted to mention. One of these crazy things. With no requirement that any evidence of drug activity actually be present before launching a drug investigation, police officers' snap judgments regarding who seems like a drug criminal would likely be influenced by prevailing racial stereotypes and bias. This is court case. They urge the court to prohibit the police from stopping motorists for the purpose of drug investigations unless the officers actually had reason to believe a motorist was committing or had committed a drug crime. Failing to do so, they argued, was unreasonable under the Fourth Amendment and would expose African Americans to a high risk of discriminatory stops and searches. Yeah, here she is talking about how the Supreme Court not adopting rules that would maximize, not minimize, the amount of racial discrimination. This is the case Wren, Whren versus United States. And then it, further on, not only did the court reject the petitioner's central claim that using traffic stops as a pretext for drug investigations is unconstitutional, it ruled that claims of racial bias could not be brought under the Fourth Amendment. In other words, the court barred any victim of race discrimination by the police from even alleging a claim of racial bias under the Fourth Amendment. According to the court, whether or not police discriminate on the basis of race when making traffic stops is irrelevant to a consideration of whether their conduct is, quote, reasonable under the Fourth Amendment. The court did offer one caveat, however. It indicated that victims of race discrimination could still state a claim under the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment, which guarantees, quote, equal treatment under the laws, end quote. This suggestion may have been reassuring to those unfamiliar with the court's equal protection jurisprudence. But for those who have actually tried to prove race discrimination under the 14th Amendment, the court's remark amounted to cruel irony. As we shall see below, the Supreme Court has made it virtually impossible to challenge racial bias in the criminal justice system under the 14th Amendment, and it has barred litigation of such claims under federal civil rights laws as well. In another case where there's a pretzel logic, racial discrimination, the court seemed to suggest, was something that simply must be tolerated in the criminal justice system, provided no one admits to racial bias. Somebody quoted here saying, the presumption of innocence is now a legal myth, he declared. And then there's something about he testified that non-black defendants were routinely prosecuted in state rather than federal court. So there's a lot, again, sometimes they're all helping each other, state, local, state, and federal. Sometimes it's contradictory. And then the sort of the character judgments that get into this stuff, blacks committed crimes, this is sort of, I think, how she's paraphrasing what the thinking is. Blacks committed crimes because of internal personality flaws, such as disrespect. Whites did so because of external conditions, such as family conflict. The decision in Armstrong effectively shields this type of biased decision-making from judicial scrutiny for racial bias. Prosecutors are well aware that the exercise of their discretion is unchecked, provided no explicitly racist remarks are made, as it is next to impossible for defendants to prove racial bias. It is difficult to imagine a system better designed to ensure that racial biases and stereotypes are given free rein, while at the same time appearing on the surface to be colorblind, than the one devised by the U.S. Supreme Court. So it's, I guess it could be sort of like, you know, his hair was, if the hairstyles are, you know, funky or whatever, and then it's like, well, the hair made them suspicious, so, you know, it becomes like a racial bias, even though it's not labeled or not even spoken that it's race. It becomes the hair. And then she mentions the whole thing, another, you know, the back side effect of, as a result, about 30% of black men are automatically barred from jury service for life. That's with the, you know, again, the check the box, the felon kind of thing. Here I have and written on the page is an effing joke. So we'll see, we'll read this paragraph. The U.S. Supreme Court reversed, holding that a pattern of race-based strikes has been identified by the defense. The prosecutor need not provide an explanation that is persuasive or even plausible. Once the reason is offered, a trial judge may choose to believe or disbelieve any silly or superstitious reason offered by prosecutors to explain a pattern of strikes that appear to be based on race. The court sent a clear message that appellate courts are largely free to accept the reasons offered by a prosecutor for excluding prospective black jurors, no matter how irrational or absurd the reasons they may seem. This was having to pick jurors, so the reasons why they don't like them. Like, here's an example. I struck juror number 22 because of the long hair. He had long, curly hair. He had the longest hair of anybody on the panel, by far. He appeared not to be a good juror for that fact. Also, he had a mustache and a goatee-type beard. And juror number 24 also had a mustache and a goatee-type beard. And I don't like the way they looked, with the way the hair is cut, both of them, and the mustaches and the beards look suspicious to me. And I have a note that it's all power politics, and that includes the Supreme Court. Here's a section. From the outset, the drug war could have been waged primarily in overwhelmingly white suburbs or on college campuses. SWAT teams could have rappelled from helicopters in gated suburban communities and raided the homes of high school lacrosse players known for hosting coke and ecstasy parties after their games. The police could have seized televisions, furniture, and cash from fraternity houses based on anonymous tip that a few joints or a stash of cocaine could be found hidden in someone's dresser drawer. Suburban homemakers could have been placed under surveillance and subjected to undercover operations designed to catch them violating laws regulating the use and sale of prescription uppers. All of this could have happened as a matter of routine in white communities, but it did not. Instead, when police go looking for drugs, they look in the hood. Tactics that would be political suicide in an upscale white suburb are not even newsworthy in poor black and brown communities. So long as mass drug arrests are concentrated in impoverished urban areas, police chiefs have little reason to fear a political backlash, no matter how aggressive and warlike the efforts may be. And so long as the number of drug arrests increases or at least remains high, federal dollars continue to flow in and fill the department's coffers. As one former prosecutor put it, it's a lot easier to go out of the hood, so to speak, and pick somebody than to put your resources in an undercover operation in a community where there are potentially politically powerful people. The hyper-segregation of the black poor in ghetto communities has made the roundup easy. Confined to ghetto areas and lacking political power, the black poor are convenient targets. Douglas Massey and Nancy Denton's book, American Apartheid, documents how racially segregated ghettos were deliberately created by federal policy, not impersonal market forces or private housing choices. So, wow, I forgot that I had read the word apartheid in the book, and so I was not deliberately titling this series by the book, but I guess, you know, the phrase is quite powerful. So there's a tip of the hat to Douglas Massey and Nancy Denton's. Might as well plug their book now, American Apartheid, even though I haven't read it. And then you're talking about law students going into neighborhoods and witness the distance between abstract legal principles and actual practice. One student reported following her ride along with Chicago police. Each time we drove into a public housing project and stopped the car, every young black man in the area would almost reflexively place his hands up against the car and spread his legs to be searched. And the officers would search them. The officers would then get back in the car and stop in another project, and this would happen again. This repeated itself throughout the entire day. I couldn't believe it. This was nothing like we learned in law school, but it just seemed so normal for the police and the young men. The court's quiet blessing of race-based traffic stops has led to something of an Orwellian public discourse regarding racial profiling. Police departments and highway patrol agencies frequently declare, "We do not engage in racial profiling," even though their officers routinely use race as a factor when making decisions regarding whom to stop and search. The justification for the implicit doublespeak, "We do not racial profile, we just stop people based on race," can be explained in part by the Supreme Court's jurisprudence. Because the Supreme Court has authorized the police to use race as a factor when making decisions regarding whom to stop and search, police departments believe that racial profiling exists only when race is the sole factor. Thus, if race is one factor but not the only factor, then it doesn't really count as a factor at all. And that, as learned from watching the Larry Wilmore show, is cray-cray, the new expression for crazy. Just wrapping up here, this chapter, The Color of Justice. In New Jersey, the data showed only 15% of all drivers on the New Jersey Turnpike were racial minorities, yet 42% of all stops and 73% of all arrests were of black motorists, despite the fact that blacks and whites violated traffic laws at almost exactly the same rate. Only 21% of all drivers along that stretch of highway were racial minorities, Latinos, Asians, and African Americans, yet those groups comprised nearly 80% of those pulled over and searched. That's in a stretch of I-95 outside Baltimore. What most surprised many analysts was that in both studies, whites were actually more likely than people of color to be carrying illegal drugs or contraband in their vehicles. That's not necessarily Baltimore, but just a stat there. And in New York Police Department, pedestrian stops too have been the subject of study and controversy. The NYPD released statistics in February 2007 showing that during the prior year, its officers were stopped an astounding 508,540 people, an average of 1,393 per day, who were walking down the street, perhaps on their way to the subway, grocery store, or bus stop. Often the stops included searches for illegal drugs or guns. Farther on, although the about Amadou Diallo, 1999, who was an African immigrant who died in a hail of police bullets. That's a sad story, I think this refers to that. Although the NYPD attempted to justify the stops on the grounds that they were designed to get guns off the street, stops by the street crime unit, the group of officers who supposedly are specially trained to identify gun-toting thugs, yielded a weapon in only 2.5% of all stops. So I think I mentioned in the first show 1%, so it was sort of close. But yeah, it sounds small, and I guess it depends how many numbers of guns and the results of crime. Still, you can see the weighted bias of the system. Paragraph and a few little bits, and that'll wrap up this chapter. Rather than reducing reliance on stopping frisk tactics following the Diallo shooting and the release of the disturbing data, the NYPD dramatically increased its number of pedestrian stops and continued to stop and frisk African Americans at grossly disproportionate rates. The NYPD stopped 5 times more people in 2005 than in 2002, the overwhelming majority of whom were African American or Latino. By 2008, the NYPD was stopping 545,000 in a single year, and 80% of the people stopped were African Americans and Latinos. Whites comprised a mere 8% of people frisked by the NYPD, while African Americans accounted for 85% of all frisks. A report by the New York Times found that the highest concentration of stops in the city was a roughly 8-block area of Brownsville, Brooklyn, that was predominantly black. Residents there were stopped at a rate 13 times the city average. And she refers to it all overall here as a ritual of dominance and submission played out hundreds of thousands of times each year. But it is more than that. These routine encounters often serve as the gateway into the criminal justice system. The NYPD made 50,300 marijuana arrests in 2010 alone, mostly of young men of color. And then in Denver, 1992, citizen activism led to an investigation which revealed that 8 out of 10 people of color in the entire city were on the list of suspected criminals. And the last paragraph in the chapter, the Supreme Court has now closed the courthouse doors to claims of racial bias at every stage of the criminal justice process, from stops and searches to plea bargaining and sentencing. The system of mass incarceration is now, for all practical purposes, thoroughly immunized from claims of racial bias. Staggering racial disparities in the drug war continue but rarely make the news. One recent development that did make news was President Obama's decision to sign legislation reducing the 100-to-1 disparity in sentencing for crack versus powder cocaine to 18-to-1, a small step in the right direction. Under the new law, it takes 28 grams of crack cocaine to net a 5-year mandatory minimum sentence, while it still takes selling 500 grams of powder cocaine to net the same sentence. There should be no disparity. The ratio should be 1-to-1. But that disparity is just the tip of the iceberg. As noted in Chapter 2, this system depends primarily on the prison label, not prison time. What matters most is who gets swept into the system of control and then ushered into an undercast. The legal rules adopted by the Supreme Court guarantee that those who find themselves locked up and permanently locked out due to the drug war are overwhelmingly black and brown. So that's part two, about halfway through the book, and shows the layers involved. So thanks for listening. Have a good one. And we'll go out with a little song by Lead Belly called Cotton Fields.
When I was a little baby, my mother rocked me in the cradle. And I'm old, old cotton fields at home. When I was a little baby, my mother would rock me in the cradle. And I'm old, cotton fields at home. Oh, when them cotton bowls get rotten, you couldn't pick very much cotton. And them old cotton fields at home. It was down in Louisiana, just a mile from Texarkana. And them old cotton fields at home. It may sound a little funny, but you didn't make very much money. And them old cotton fields at home. It may sound a little funny, but you didn't make very much money. And them old cotton fields at home. Oh, when them cotton bowls get rotten, you can't pick very much cotton. And them old cotton fields at home. It was down in Louisiana, just a mile from Texarkana. And them old cotton fields at home. I was over in Arkansas, people asked me, what you come here for? Saw people ask me what you come here for, and the more cotton field at home. Oh, when the cotton bowls get rotten, you can't pick very much cotton, and the more cotton field at home. It was down in Louisiana, just a mile from Texarkana, and the more cotton field at home. Oh, when the cotton bowls get rotten, you can't pick very much cotton, and the more